Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. State Question 788 goes before Oklahoma voters in just a few weeks on primary day, June 26th. And as debate continues on whether Oklahomans should legalize the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes, my guest today is a physician researcher who has researched the substance's efficacy in pain and palliative care and utilizes marijuana today in his private practice in metropolitan Seattle, Washington. Dr. Sunil Kumar Agarwal is an Oklahoma native of Muskogee with degrees from University of California at Berkeley, the University of Washington, and was a fellow at the National Institute of Health in Palliative Care. Currently, he's a physician scientist in private practice specializing in palliative and rehabilitative care. He's a clinical instructor at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and he's the chair of the Integrative Medicine Group for the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. Dr. Agarwal is in the state today, actually, speaking with medical professionals today here in Tulsa and tomorrow in Oklahoma City. I spoke with him last week from his clinic in Washington. Dr. Agarwal, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great pleasure to be with you, Rich.
Yeah, and welcome home to Oklahoma, even by phone. You're an Oklahoma native. But in your private practice and research, your focus is on pain and palliative care and the use of cannabis and cannabinoids in that practice. How effective has marijuana been in this area?
It's been incredibly effective. There's no question about it. Before I began utilizing it in practice, I reviewed the literature and did my own research as a doctoral student and tracked patients. In one of my studies, I studied 139 patients at a specialty pain clinic who had been using cannabis under medical authorization here in Washington State. The total number of years of authorized medical cannabis use was over 240 years in that sample of patients in their mostly 40s, 50s, males and females. And they had a great number of pain conditions that were being relieved with cannabis, myofascial pain syndromes, neuropathic pain syndromes, discogenic pain syndromes.
If you can put those into layman's terms, we're talking back pain, we're talking nervous system pains, like phantom pains.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the myofascial pain is pain related to soft tissues. It can be chronic and debilitating itself. Discogenic, you know, the discs of the back and the spine that can become impaired or desiccated or cause impingement. Neuropathic pain, you know, injuries related to and disorders of the nerves themselves, that is a very difficult to treat type of pain. Central pain syndromes were, I had patients who had multiple sclerosis or traumatic brain injuries. It was a pretty impressive sample of, you know, patients who had multiple pain syndromes, not just one in some cases. The results of this study I published in the Journal of Opioid Management a number of years ago of these 139 patients with multiple pain syndromes. It was really striking to see how many patients reported significant pain relief, the only thing that they would ever, only thing that's ever been effective for them in some cases. In other cases, dose reductions of their opioid drugs and other classes of medicines that they had been previously prescribed. No patient discontinued due to any adverse effect in the sample. And they had, there was patients with pain syndromes of numerous etiologies, traumatic patients who had Lou Gehrig's disease, so neurodegenerative disorders and so forth. So the one issue was significant barriers that they had related to access, the legal system not approving what they were doing, even though it had been legal in the state. So stigma was a big barrier as well. I think that kind of research helped me to understand that. And then I myself reviewed the randomized controlled trial literature as well and published an article in the Clinical Journal of Pain, which appeared on the cover of the journal a few years ago. And in that case, I reviewed all the controlled studies that had been published with cannabis and cannabinoids in pain. And I believe it was something like 78% of them were positive outcome studies, meaning that the active group using cannabis and cannabinoids had superior, result compared to the control.
Now, I'm not a scientist, but lumping together all sorts of different pain symptoms, does that affect the results in any way of getting you a sense of what it's especially effective for? Did you break those out into say, neuromuscular disorders versus your soft tissue to see where cannabis was more or less effective?
Right. I mean, what's interesting is pain, after it goes on for more than 3 or 4 months, it becomes a disorder in itself. And it's kind of a unique type of condition. And the nervous system itself undergoes certain changes that are kind of common in multiple chronic pain etiologies, or, you know, multiple chronic causes. There's phenomenon that happen in the central nervous system called the wind-up and central sensitization. So your normal mechanisms of suppressing pain that occur after a tissue injury, they just don't work anymore or don't work as well.
So your nerves are sending messages of pain, whether or not there is actual pain manifesting itself at a moment?
Whether or not there's an actual new injury we have a system in our bodies called the descending pain pathways that help to tamp down excessive pain signals. People will recognize the system when they're being chased by a tiger or bear in the woods and they stub their toe. They will not feel pain of their stubbed toe if they hit a tree. Otherwise, it would be very painful. But due to the stress situation, you have an analgesia. And that has been determined in a very reputable scientific journal, Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, that whole system of suppressing pain due to stress is due to the endocannabinoid signaling system. And that is unique. That is one of the unique mechanisms by which cannabis or marijuana has its therapeutic effects.
So instead of sending like a huge amount of stress hormones and stress adrenaline and the like, it's basically masking those sorts of responses from the body from a hugely stress-oriented perspective and inducing sort of a stop to the pain signals.
Yeah, it helps to ramp up the body's natural system to suppress pain. And then that's just sort of the nervous system angle. There's also anti-inflammatory effects of these class of botanical medicine acts to reduce chronic inflammation that you can also see in chronic pain syndromes, again, of numerous origins, by acting on the cytokines, which are the signaling molecules that immune cells release. And so you can tamp that down as well through the cannabinoid receptors on those tissues. And then there's also cannabinoid receptors in the peripheral nerves, like the signals that just directly come up from the tissues. So, and those are also cannabinoid responsive. So there's multiple ascending, descending, central and peripheral mechanisms by which cannabinoids seem to be relieving pain. And that's why you end up seeing a variety of pain conditions, chronic pain conditions, that seem to be helped. It's very unique. You know, opioids don't have this many mechanisms. Even your NSAIDs, like ibuprofen and Tylenol, Tylenol, it turns out, seems to also be doing something in the endocannabinoid system, which is really interesting. People have been using Tylenol or acetaminophen for so many years, they didn't really understand how it worked until we discovered the endocannabinoid system. So there are shades of this in other medicines that people use for pain, but none that are as robust.
Now, given the fact that we're hearing about opioid addictions and opiates, use of opiates, what's most encouraging about your research and the research you've been following on marijuana that may lead to a reduction of the prescriptive use? Or does it eliminate it, or does it just reduce the need for it?
Right. I mean, you can look at that data in several different ways. You can look at how in states that have allowed cannabis for medical use, what has been the rate of hospitalization due to opioid-related mortality and morbidity, like overdoses or, severe sedation or even, you know, near death. Those numbers go down in states that have had operating medical cannabis programs. There's a company that's called Searchlight that does a lot of claims processing for employers in multiple states. The number of opioid prescriptions filled, according to their claims, go down in states that have medical cannabis use allowed. And then those very famous studies that have been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association are showing reduced opioid-related deaths in states that are, just looking at vital statistics in states that have allowed medical cannabis use. Then you can look at Medicare Part D prescription drug data showing reductions in the number of opioids and other classes of medicines filled. Like Medicare is paying for less of those classes of drugs after states allow medical cannabis use. So that's the kind of public health population level data. Then you can look at it from, you know, these individual cases and case series, like my case series of 139 patients. I saw reductions and eliminations, not always eliminations, but in some cases eliminations. In other cases, what we call pharmaceutical sparing. So you're using them more sparingly.
Right.
And that's very important, too. Most of the problems with opioids come from using them more liberally than you should. And I think that's an important point that we've seen in the clinical studies. And then finally, there's been controlled clinical studies that have been done where they take patients who are on long-acting opioids and they bring them into the hospital for 5 days and allow them to inhale cannabis of various strengths. And in those, this one study that was published with patients who were on long-acting oxycodone, long-acting morphine, when they had pain conditions of various types, it turned out that when they inhaled cannabis, they were able to reduce their pain scores by 30 or 40%. And it turned out in the blood, they sampled their blood, the active metabolite of the opioid was actually a little bit lower. So even though their blood level of their opioid was lower, they had better pain relief, and they were keeping on their same long-acting dose. Mm. So it tells us that it may even enhance the safety of using opioids because the blood level of the opioid is correlated with overdose.
My guest today is Sunil Kumar Agarwal. He's a physician scientist in private practice in the Seattle area, specializing in palliative and rehabilitative care. He's also affiliated with the University of Washington School of Medicine and teaches medical geography at the University of Washington as well. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Oklahoma voters will decide State Question 788 on June 26, which would legalize the licensed cultivation, use, and possession of marijuana for medicinal purposes in the state. Earlier, you were talking about the downside of what you saw, and it was mainly barriers because in certain locales, it's very difficult to get medicinal marijuana or for their use, and the stigma. Did you run into quite a bit of stigma of people just not wanting to use marijuana? If you look at a blue-collar worker that's been that has lower back pain, do they just not want to use it to begin with?
Yes, that's certainly the case. And many times their employers wouldn't allow it, even if the state allows it. So those kind of challenges are real and are there. And I kind of coined this deconditioning cannabis as contraband. We have to work on deconditioning ourselves that this is a contraband. It's going to be a significant challenge in Oklahoma. I grew up in Muskogee, and I know what I heard growing up from my teachers and the community about the dangers of drugs and marijuana in particular. And, it was the emphasis was on stay away, and if you don't, we're going to get you. In Muskogee High School, where I went for 2 years, the student group that was formed to prevent drugs use was called RAID, R-A-I-D, Ruffers Against Illegal Drugs. So it wasn't, we're trying to help you. It's like, hey, we're going to raid you, And right. So that kind of fear conditioning, I think it's very hard to, it's a very significant barrier to overcome. But many times patients still nevertheless tried it, but they wanted to have, doctors to validate that because they were able to get, improved function, improved quality of life, reduced pain, and reduced prescription drug use. In my studies of the medical records, the patients would state many times that they were not drug abusers, that they were not recreational users. They were just wanting to use cannabis medicinally so that they can improve their function and quality of life. Other patients may have had a legal proceeding going on because of some unrelated legal issue. And the judge would rule, well, if you're under these proceedings, you're not allowed to use any kind of drugs that are not prescribed. And then, and because in those days they didn't really honor medical cannabis as a drug that's being medically approved, these patients would have to go without it. And it wasn't like it was necessarily going to worsen their outcomes in the law, in the court of law. It was just not being recognized. But what's nice about the Oklahoma initiative is that a lot of these barriers that these all these other states have had trying to implement these laws, they are already kind of pre-planned for. And they tell the employers, listen, you can't just fire somebody if they're using cannabis if it's under medical authorization and they're not being delinquent or, you know, not performing well. They tell the courts, they tell the, you know, the rest of the state agencies, you treat this like a equivalent to a prescription. This is the way it should be.
Now, you got into the arguments of State Question 788. I know opponents will say, you know, there's not a list of qualifying conditions. It really is relying on state regulators to really make the rules about the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes. What about that idea that, you know, there should be a list of qualifying conditions? In essence, they say it's basically creating a way to get a license for recreational use of marijuana.
People worry about that because they haven't educated themselves on all the conditions that we have evidence to support cannabis use. Most drugs that doctors prescribe, they don't have any qualifying conditions. And doctors want to keep it that way. They don't want the state telling them, oh, this medicine, you can only prescribe it for this type of condition. Because we know in medicine that there's nobody that's going to fit the exact rule. There's always going to be somebody that has that condition and this other condition and have intolerance to this class of drug and has tried and failed this and has an allergy. So, you know, clinical practice is messy. And you have to have, you know, rely on the thousands and thousands of hours of training that physicians get, that they are, and, you know, of course, their licenses and their board certifications and their, you know, oversight by the state to make good clinical decisions and to monitor for safety. That itself is enough. Medical boards can still discipline if people are not doing good faith medical practice and within the standards of medical practice. Unfortunately, this happens all the time. I mean, and disciplinary issues and OBGYNs and other care. I just keep reading articles about, you know, abusive things. You're going to have bad actors and in many fields. But to have there's a lot of states, even a Federation of State Medical Boards, which is kind of the oversight body for all the medical boards of the country. They have, you know, developed some guidelines for physician recommendation of cannabis, the Medical Board of California, the Medical Board in Washington and Colorado. So it's not like we're just going to, Oklahoma, we'll just have to start from scratch. You know, this has been happening in medical practice in the U.S. since 1996. So you can certainly educate the doctors. Here are some common conditions that cannabis is being used for. Here are reasonable doses that you can recommend to patients. You know, THC, a standard adult dose, is 5 milligrams, and you should maybe start it at nighttime and maybe cut that in half just to make sure people are safe. And here's how you can titrate that. And here's a limit where you might get more side effects. All of that can be educated, and that's how we do it for prescribing any other drug. You know, if you get a prescription for colchicine for your gout, you know, doctors already know here's a limit of that drug and here's how much you should be taking. And if you take more than that, you'll run into problems. But it's not like we say colchicine can only be used for gout because there might be another condition that it turns out that colchicine is helpful for. So I think that anxiety is really a fear of the unknown. And I do think it's incumbent on the state to make sure their medical professionals meet the education needs that are educated in the way that the people of the state want them to be. So I don't really believe in mandatory, but they can strongly encourage them to be educated. And there's many modules available. And, you know, I'm going to be giving a talk in Tulsa to medical professionals, and I'm happy to come again. And there's many other doctors I know who and researchers who and CME providers. There's now whole companies that are have developed accredited medical education around cannabis and medicine and the cannabinoid system. And I think it's really important for doctors to learn.
My guest today is Dr. Sunil Kumar Agarwal, a physician scientist in private practice. He does research on palliative and rehabilitative care, and he specializes in that. He's also affiliated with the University of Washington School of Medicine. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to ask you about the impairment issue, because that's the other thing that opponents will get into, this idea that you're going to create a new class of impaired people walking around. Has that been the case in your own practice when you prescribe marijuana?
Oh, no, it's not a concern. I mean, people can get impaired when they misuse or overuse any number of prescribed drugs. So the whole goal of medical practice is to keep people in a safe area with these medicines. When people have pain conditions, they really and they use cannabis, it's actually, as long as their doses and their usage is in a reasonable window, they don't get impaired. They get more functional, and I think that's really, again, part of the reefer madness myth that cannabis is so dangerous that you take a little bit, you'll turn loco.
Well, anybody who's used it knows it's very different than alcohol, but you are able to be pretty well impaired with the substance if you smoke too much or you ingest too much.
That's right, and that's why we say you take a little bit. And the other thing is THC is not the only game in town. CBD, which is a structural isomer of THC, meaning that they're so similar to each other. CBD, the ring is open, and THC, the ring is closed. But when you put the two together, it seems to blunt many of the most psychoactive aspects of THC, dysphoria, anxiety, and even cognitive issues. So it's a really good idea to have some CBD around to help to balance that. And the other thing, when patients have chronic conditions because of chronic symptoms, cannabinoid, if you treat that, they actually improve their outcomes. And where the same kind of drug, if you gave it to somebody that didn't have a problem, they might have a side effect. So it really isn't a one-size-fits-all thing. You have to see it as a therapeutic. And then two other things I want to say about that is that cannabinoids have a neuroprotective property. So when people have cognitive impairment after a head injury or after a stroke, a lot of research is suggesting that if they have cannabinoids in their body or administer them, that it might improve their cognitive performance and recovery from the brain injury. There was a study done at the University of Southern California Medical Center, published in the journal American Surgeon Journal a couple of years ago, that showed patients who had traumatic brain injuries admitted to the hospital, if they tested positive for cannabinoids in their urine in the emergency room, their recovery from the brain injury was faster. Their admission time in the hospital was less. So it's not just a made-up thing. It's a really legitimate fact. And this was recently, because Massachusetts has now legalized medical marijuana, Harvard got involved in studies of patients using medical cannabis for pain, and they actually tracked their cognitive performance from the beginning to the end, and they also did functional brain imaging. And they did things like something called the Stroop word test, where a color, like the color green, is spelled in blue letters. And so you still have to figure out what the word says and what the color is, even though the word is spelled with a different color than the color of the letters. So those are kind of classic psychological tests for cognitive speed and processing. And it turned out in this series of patients they studied who had chronic pain, who were using medical cannabis, their cognitive performance improved in those tests, and their brain imaging showed improvements as well.
How difficult is it to do research in this day and age? Even though states have legalized, your state, for example, it's legalized for recreational use as well as medical use, but given its federal illegality, is it still difficult to do research?
Yeah, we can't do it in this country. You have to go do the research in Israel or, in some European countries where the laws are much, and even Canada, research is becoming much more easy to do because they have a federal program. Research is one of the most, risky things that we do to people. Lots of vulnerable human subjects. So we have all these laws and rules. So it turns out that, you really need to follow lots of review board ethics.
to do research, and that generally involves agencies. FDA, if you're giving a drug to a patient and it's not FDA approved, then, you know, what are you going to, you need to show us lots of data. Or in cannabis's case, the government considers it so dangerous, they only allow one approved cultivator, yeah, even though we have all these state programs. So it makes it very hard and challenging to get a accepted supply and to get a review board to kind of go along with that. Even though the state, now, nowadays, several states are writing into their laws that, hey, listen, you can still conduct some research with this cannabis in your hospital facility. Pennsylvania has that in their law. I believe Minnesota has that in their law. And I know in Connecticut, they're doing research over time. You can still track these things. You just can't directly hand, like the doctor can't hand the pill or the medical cannabis to the patient and say, here, take this, and then they hand the placebo to the other patient and take this, you know, which is really a controlled study should be done. That level, it's very hard to do without all those checks, but you can still collect data on outcomes prospectively.
And that's where we're at in this country right now. It's collecting outcome data, right?
Yes, and a lot of that has been done. And despite the restrictions, we've had over 120 or 130 controlled clinical trials of cannabis and cannabinoids. That's in the medical literature. Like, so it's not like these studies haven't been done. They haven't been done for all the conditions we'd like to see them for, but there are, we still have a number that have been done. And the other thing is, because the pharmaceutical industry is really interested in cannabis, they've made their own cannabis liquid preparation, which has also been funded by Bayer Pharmaceuticals. They raised venture capital and funded their own studies with liquid cannabis extract. And those are published, and we also can guide our knowledge base based on their studies in pain. But those companies still insist that their product is different from marijuana, but it's made from marijuana. It's a one-to-one preparation of THC and CBD. So, well, you have to read literature.
Yeah. But to test against a control group, which is really determining how effective it is, we really can't do that in this country, right?
Well, no, believe it or not, those trials for that GW ran for this product that I was mentioning, the U.S. allowed them to import it into the country from England and then allowed them to conduct studies on American patients. So we have American data in randomized placebo-controlled trials of cannabis in liquid form that show, compared to placebo, it's effective for pain. It's true, if you're an academic researcher, you know, at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences, and you want to find out, you know, if the cannabis being produced in your state or in the neighboring state has efficacy in a condition you're interested in studying, it's going to be a long road.
Yeah.
But if you have friends in the pharmaceutical industry who have access to cannabis supply and are allowed to make it, you might be able to have an easier time. So the restrictions are kind of, I guess you can say, two-faced. It depends on who you are, whether you're a small, you know, time academic researcher or a big pharmaceutical company. I'm sorry to say, it's kind of like that kind of game.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Dr. Sunil Agarwal is a physician and scientist in private practice in metropolitan Seattle, Washington, specializing in palliative and rehabilitative care, and he uses marijuana in the course of his practice and has also researched its medical uses. State Question 788 goes before Oklahoma voters on June 26th. That would legalize the licensed cultivation, use, and possession of marijuana for medicinal purposes. Marijuana is fully legal in the District of Columbia and 9 states, and medicinally legal in an additional 20 states. We'll hear more on this issue prior to the June 26th vote. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.